It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Sally Swift, in this week for Lynn Rossetto Casper. Every cook needs to feel their heart beat a little faster every now and then, even the pros. Take Yota Motolenghi. What's he excited about these days?
Curry leaves. They are so wonderfully aromatic. In the same way we do in European cooking, start our dishes with some chopped onion and carrot and celery. Often in Indian cooking and Southeast Asian, you start with curry leaves, ginger, chili, maybe some mustard seeds. And it's just the most wonderfully aromatic thing. So often now, whenever I cook, I drop a few curry leaves into the pan when I just start cooking a stew or roasted vegetables. And it just gives the most wonderful flavor.
Yotam Ottolenghi, and how does a critic pick America's 10 best food cities? Carefully, I bet. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Sally Swift. We have big changes afoot here at The Splendid Table. In case you've not heard, after 20-plus years of doing this weekly show, Lynn has decided to have her own life. Yep, it's true. She's retiring at the end of the year. But there is a silver lining. We have a new host. His name is Francis Lamb, and we are psyched. You have heard him here as a contributor and guest host over the years. You may have seen him as a judge on Top Chef Masters and read his column in the New York Times Magazine. Well, now he is ours. In the upcoming months, you'll be hearing shows that Lynn hosts and also shows with Francis hosting. In fact, his first new show is next week. You're also going to hear some guest hosts as well throughout the rest of the year. And the big question, yes, Turkey Confidential will live on. But for today, we are listening back to a milestone from last year, our 600th episode. It was a different world back in episode one. The Food Network was just starting. The only celebrity chefs, well, were actually chefs. People did not throw around the words organic and sustainable. Kale was an obscure green, and quinoa could only be tracked down in a co-op. Well, we are happy to be part of the ongoing food conversation, and we can't wait to see where it's going to go. Wherever it does, I am pretty confident that one of the people that's going to stay in the lead is Chef Yotam Ottolenghi. He's a one-man empire with an eponymous restaurant group in London, politics that address equality across nationalities and sexes, and a slew of best-selling books that have put the flavors of the Middle East directly into the heart of everyday eating. He's back with a new book inspired by his fine dining restaurant in London called Nopi. He's co-written it with his head chef, Ramal Scully, a man who was born in Malaysia but raised in Australia. Our contributor, Russ Parsons, talked to Yotam about what happens when Asian influences mingle with the Middle East.
Yotam, it's so great to have you on, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Russ. It's an absolute pleasure.
You know, one of the things I found interesting was that the book's very much a collaboration between you and the chef, Ramal Scully. And it's interesting that you're from a Middle Eastern background and he's from a Malaysian background. They're very different cuisines, but both areas are kind of, they've served as crossroads for many cultures. How does that inform the food at Nopi?
That's absolutely true. I mean, I think Scully and I, although we were both growing up eating different types of food, both Malaysia and the Middle East, or Israel, where I was growing up, are places where quite a few cultures meet and combine. And as a result, I think there isn't one clear tradition of cooking. There's lots of traditions that are kind of competing. It's not like, you know, Italy or Lebanon or, you know, quite unified places where you have a very clear single tradition that is a dominant one. And as a result of that, I think there is a certain freedom. And I think both Scully, as we call him, and myself have that freedom to create because we have grown up eating very mixed kind of cuisines. I mean, I've grown up eating Middle Eastern, Jewish, European food, and Scully was having Malaysian food, which is very much a mix of Indian, Malay, and quite a bit of Chinese. And all that comes into our foods, both his and mine.
There have been so many bad versions of fusion cooking, you guys seem to have found a way to make it work. What's the secret to doing fusion cooking and having it be respectful of the cultures, but also having it be delicious?
I been thinking about it quite a lot. I think I don't think fusion is bad by definition, but, you know, bad versions of fusions mix things just for the sake of mixing. I mean, you go to a place and it says on the menu, Japan meets Italy, and there's someone in some room in an office thought that that would be an interesting combination. It's never something that we think about in such a way. We constantly talk about food, eat, and try things. And sometimes, on some occasions, we say, hey, why don't we try to smoke the aubergine, which is a typical technique in the Middle East, and add it to something which is slightly more Japanese flavors. It doesn't mean that we're trying very hard to combine the two cuisines. All it is that we're trying to take some of our experience and mix it in areas that we are exploring. I think it's very important to be respectful and delicate when you do cross-cultural things like those, and that's what we're trying to do the whole time.
One of the things that you're really well known for with your books is that painstaking care that you take with the development of the recipes, and you know, everything is so thoroughly tested, and people just have great success when they cook the recipes. But that's different for when you're developing recipes for a home cook and for a restaurant cookbook. Was the process different for a restaurant cookbook?
Yes, you're absolutely right. The books that I've published in the past were mostly conceived and thought through in a domestic kitchen, in a home kitchen. I was often thinking, okay, how do home cooks cook? This time, the dishes that are in the book have actually been cooked in the restaurant in Nopi for quite a few years. So we had to take them and turn them into something that home cooks can actually make. And this was very important for me, to make it very doable for home cooks. I didn't want to make it into one of these restaurant cookbooks that everybody looks at with great admiration but never dare take into their kitchen. Mm-hmm. So Scully and I spent almost 2 years taking recipes that are slightly complicated and simplifying it or standardizing them or doing things that would allow home cooks to do them. And I think in the restaurants we have the luxury of having a team of people working in order to put something on the plate which is complex, interesting, but occasionally also a little bit vain. And I'm talking about the vanity of the chef, and I take full responsibility for that. I mean, you want to have it look a little bit more special than what you would cook at home. So there's certain elements that are there for the restaurant's sake, but are not absolutely essential. And those are the elements that we have taken out or tamed a little bit. You know, we have a recipe in the book for mackerel with a fresh salad of coconut and peanut salad. So it ended up being something pretty simple, which is pan-fried fish, a beautiful fresh salad using fresh coconut, peanuts, mint, all sorts of, you know, Asian flavors. In the restaurant itself, it probably had another element. I mean, it probably had some kind of a mash. If I'm not mistaken, it had a Jerusalem artichoke mash on the bottom. I mean, that's not essential for the dish. It's something that we could have easily have left out, but still have all the key flavors. So little compromises you can easily do and still feel that you kind of kept the integrity of a dish.
Now, whenever we talk, one of the things I love to ask you is, because, every time I cook from your recipes, I'm discovering new ingredients, and you go through it seems like you're like me in a way. You go through these mad passions for different ingredients.
Yes.
So with Nopi, you're actually cooking with somebody else's palate to a certain extent. Scully was very much a part of that. What did you fall in love with during the testing for the Nopi cookbook?
Absolutely. Curry leaves. So I've known curry leaves before, but Scully cooks with a lot of curry leaves. I mean, part of his heritage is Indian, and this is just a wonderful thing. There's a recipe in Plenty More, which is a result of my work with Scully already when I worked on the previous book, and has a steamed rice with curry leaves and lemon juice. It's the simplest thing, but they are so wonderfully aromatic. And the same way we do in European cooking, start our dishes with some chopped onion and carrot and celery. Often in Indian cooking and Southeast Asian, you start with curry leaves, ginger, chili, maybe some mustard seeds. And it's just the most wonderfully aromatic thing. So often now, whenever I cook, I drop a few curry leaves into the pan when I just start cooking a stew or roasted vegetables. And it just gives the most wonderful flavor. Pandan leaves, another Southeast Asian ingredient used both for savory and sweet cooking. It's a kind of, it's the Asian equivalent of vanilla. Wonderfully aromatic. So quite a few new ingredients that I completely fell in love with. I use miso all the time, and I never used to cook with miso. So yeah, definitely opened my mind in many directions.
As always, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Russ. It was my pleasure.
Yoda Motolenghi is co-author of Nopi with Ramal Scully. Russ Parsons is a longtime food writer and author of the classic How to Pick a Peach. Find Yodam and Ramal's recipe for pistachio and pine nut crusted halibut with wild arugula and parsley vichyssoise at splendidtable.org. And by the way, for those who struggle with cooking rice, check out my digital piece, 3 Fail-Safe Methods for Cooking Rice. I write about that curry-scented rice that Yodam talked about. It's really delicious and a crazy interesting technique. You kind of can't fail. You'll find it all there, splendidtable.org. One of our goals on this show is to get people fired up about what they can do in their kitchens. And with that goal in mind, we've teamed up with the powerhouse team of cooks at America's Test Kitchen. They have spent decades empowering home cooks. Jack Bishop, the chief creative officer, joins us today. Jack, nice to have you back.
Hey, Sally. Nice to be with you.
So tell me, what have you been working on?
So I've been doing my job for a fairly long time, and I sometimes think, oh, I can't possibly be surprised. But I was surprised by a recent taste test of vegan, yes, you heard me right, vegan mayonnaise. Yeah, we had done this tasting maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and they were all awful. You know, mayonnaise has got very few ingredients, one of them being egg, and remove the egg, and it was a disaster. But we read that 7-Eleven had recently switched over to using vegan mayonnaise in all their prepared foods and thought, well, maybe 7-Eleven knows something, or maybe
vegan
mayonnaise has gotten good. Yeah, it's a little kind of crazy. But so we went back. There are some new brands out there, and we did a taste test of 6 vegan mayonnaise, and we liked 3 of them, and one of them we loved.
So back up a little bit for me. What replaces the egg in vegan mayonnaise?
Yeah, so some things are the same. They still have either vinegar or lemon juice, and they're a lot of oil. But then they need some sort of emulsifier, and there are 3 choices. Modified food starch, which is what historically has been used and will create a greasy, lumpy mayonnaise. That's not a good choice. And then there's soy protein, which is okay, but these new brands are using pea protein. It is protein extracted from looks like yellow split peas, basically. And it keeps the oil and the vinegar or lemon juice in emulsion. And our top 2 brands both use pea protein. And it does an amazing job of creating a creamy, not greasy, eggless mayonnaise.
Okay, you have to name names. I can't believe this.
Yes, so our winner was Hampton Creek Just Mayo. It's a new company. It's gotten a lot of press. It's a startup, a couple years old. And believe it or not, when we then pitted it against Hellman's Real Mayonnaise, which is the Test Kitchen's favorite, you know, it's traditional mayonnaise, we couldn't tell the difference.
Wow.
Whether we tasted it straight from the jar, we used it in a salad dressing, whether we slathered it on grilled cheese, we thought they were both good. They both did exactly what you want commercial mayonnaise to be doing.
And that was heads and tails above the others?
The Hampton Creek was the only one that was pure recommended.
Okay.
We had 2 that fell into our sort of recommended with reservations. They were good, but they weren't as good as the Hampton Creek.
So what were the others that you tasted?
So the Earth Balance was another one that we thought was recommended with reservations, or a brand called Follow Your Heart. The interesting thing is that the Hellman's Vegan, we did not like at all. It's one of the ones that used the modified food starch. So while we love Hellman's regular mayonnaise with eggs, they have not perfected the art of vegan mayonnaise yet.
Wow. Rock on, 7-Eleven. I guess we're going to be keeping in touch with them, huh? They're ahead of the curve.
You know, sometimes you get news from places you don't expect.
Hey, Jack. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sally.
Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer at America's Test Kitchen. You can find that list of vegan mayonnaise on the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, Jack will be back next week with the winning list of extra virgin olive oils. Now, olive oil is spendy, so which ones are really worth the dough? You're going to find out. Coming up, how could anyone decide on what the 10 best food cities are in America? Well, let the battle begin. I'm Sally Swift. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Sally Swift. Ask most people what the best food city is, and everyone has an opinion. So imagine how touchy it is for a food critic in a major publication to take on the task of naming names and ranking the 10 best cities. Well, Washington Post food critic Tom Sietsma did that very thing in a series he wrote over 9 months, involving 12 cities, visiting 270 bars, restaurants, and stores, and he has lived to tell the tale. So, Tom, nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So, were you crazy taking on this project? I mean, food is politics almost.
Wow. Well, you know, it was so daunting early on. I didn't know at the beginning that I was going to be spending 2 months eating in about 300 places, visiting 12 cities that turned out to be 10 fully ranked cities. And, you know, had I known all that ahead of time and the poundage that I was going to gain and the sleepless nights and all of that, I would have started earlier, let's put it that way.
And I'm sure, have you gotten hate mail from people?
Oh, sure. You know, everyone whose city was dissed or left off the list or lower on the list than they thought it should be, I felt like I heard from all these people.
I'm sure you did. So tell me what the 10 cities that made it work.
Sure. Well, starting from the bottom, moving on up, I went to Charleston. Washington was number 9. New York was number 8. Number 7 was Chicago. Philly was 6. Houston was 5. That was a surprise. New Orleans was 4. Los Angeles was 3. San Francisco, my old stomping grounds, was number 2. And Portland, Oregon, was number 1.
And what were your criteria? How did you judge these cities?
Sure. I mean, I felt it was important not just to go in with like, oh, I think this is good or this is bad, but my editor, Joe Yonan, who's the food and dining editor of the Washington Post, sort of sat down and we came up with 5 criteria. And they included creativity. They included tradition. They included a sense of community. They included service and shopping. And unlike a lot of writers who go to cities to evaluate them, this is different. This project was a little different in that I wasn't just looking at restaurants, new restaurants. I was looking at old restaurants, new restaurants. I was looking at bars. I was looking at bakeries and shops and farm markets. So I was looking at food in a much broader context than most people do. Sure. Mm-hmm.
So you said Houston was a surprise. That was a surprise to me, too.
Houston was a big surprise. And in each of these cities, what I did was try and eat with locals, not just the local restaurant critics, but also historians and you know people who you know publishers and people who had lived there for a while. Mm-hmm. So I would listen to their stories over these meals. And Houston was interesting. Well, for a couple of reasons, I was surprised at the diversity there. I was surprised. I knew how big it was going to be. I didn't know how large their Indian population would be. I felt when I ate there, I've been to Vietnam and China. I had meals in Houston that equaled some of the better meals that I've had in Vietnam and China before. I mean, it was really stunning. And, you know, what hit home when I was down there was that, you know, it's on this port city. It's one of the largest ports in the country. I think it's 2 or 3 in terms of, you know, tonnage and what comes in and what goes out. And, you know, that accounts for a lot of it. But it's also the climate down there. One person, one local told me, if L.A. and New Orleans had a baby, it would be Houston. You know, in terms of the climate and
sense.
The traditions and the way you feel and the love of food, you know, it all added up.
Now, the other interesting city for me on the list was Philadelphia. And the thing that was interesting for me is that how much great vegan and vegetarian food is coming out of there.
Right.
How
did
that happen?
It's such a blue-collar town. I mean, people there will tell you it's such a blue-collar town. You know, they've got like something like 50 breweries. They have this great Italian tradition. All these iconic foods, most of which involve large quantities of meat.
And salt,
you know? Yes. And salt, right? And fat. that was a big surprise for me. I had some of the best vegetarian or vegan food I've had anywhere in the country at places like Veg and other restaurants that really demonstrate that it doesn't have to be earthy crunchy, that mm-hmm. there's room for, you know, an aspect of fine dining and vegetarian food.
So who are these chefs that are doing that there? And did they come from Philly? Are they people that have come back to Philly, which I think we're seeing a lot of chefs returning to their hometowns after being in New York or L.A.?
Right. That's one thing that fueled a lot of cities, I noticed. You know, chefs who have worked for great chefs elsewhere are coming home either because the real estate markets are so high in places mm-hmm. like San Francisco or New York, or they want to reunite with their families or live or raise their kids in a more hospitable environment, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And what city was the most disappointing?
You know, this is the big surprise. New York. Mm. New York was the biggest disappointment, and it was also the city that I spent the most time in. I actually went there twice because I really felt, a city as large as New York, 45,000 restaurants, I needed to give it more time.
45,000 restaurants.
45,000 restaurants, right? And so it was really daunting just coming up with a list of, you know, I went over these lists with former critics and current critics and diehard chow hounds up in New York, just to get a sense, tip of the iceberg kind of sense of this city. And I guess part of my disappointment was explained by the fact that, you know, we have very high expectations for New York.
Exactly.
This is the city that has won more James Beard Awards than any other city. Its chefs sort of start and groom trends around the country. So our expectations are and should be very high. And place after place kept letting me down. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't a week of total disappointment. I ate some stellar food at Le Bernardin and a number of the four-star places. But, even some of the iconic places like Peter Luger's was, you know, wow, you have to have been born in Brooklyn and gone to this place since you were a wee one to thoroughly enjoy this place.
So what do you think makes a good food city?
You know, I was going over my lists and my surveys afterwards, and I thought, what is it? What, you know, bottom line, haiku, what makes a great food city? And I found that if a market is near a large body of water, that mm-hmm, helps. Mm-hmm. If there's a tradition of iconic foods, you know, if you have two or three dishes that everyone associates with that city,
like
that
New
helps.
Orleans.
Like New Orleans, mm-hmm. like Philly with the cheesesteaks, mm-hmm. like San Francisco with a Chopino or the Mission Burritos, you know, and on and on and on. That helps, certainly. And it also helps if a population likes to drink. I mean, I look at places.
No, there is an honest answer.
You know, I was thinking, well, yeah, it's true because, you know, in San Francisco, you've got the wine country nearby and some great breweries. Philly, you know, their beer culture mm-hmm. is huge. And New Orleans, well,
they drink everything.
They drink everything.
Tom, thanks so much for coming in. It's an interesting list.
It's been a pleasure.
Tom Sietsma is food critic for The Washington Post. You can get a look at his top 10 American food cities at splendidtable.org. By the way, it's our 600th episode this week, and while we've been covering all of the food trends over these 600 episodes, we've noticed that some recipes just stand the test of time. No matter what today's IT chefs or bloggers claim, you only have to take a look at your Pinterest feed to see that certain recipes just keep rising to the top. They are classics. Well, in honor of our 600th episode, instead of putting together yet another list of classic recipes, we've put together something even better. It's a list of classic kitchen advice, the tricks, the techniques, the ideas that we've learned from our guests over the years. It's an interesting lineup. You'll find it at splendidtable.org, and let us know which ones really strike home for you. And send us your best tricks. Get in touch. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Let us know. Dessa is an internationally known recording artist. She travels the world with Doomtree Collective, performing her own style of hip-hop poetry. Not just a performer, she wears many different hats. Business executive, writer, philosopher, and her years on the road have turned her into a bit of a food activist. Dessa joined Lynn on stage at the Fitzgerald Theater a few months back to talk about the philosophical and logistical issues of taking a stance on how you eat.
You know, I think people know your music, but I think there's a side to you perhaps they don't know, that you have a lot of work that you've done with food politics. How did that begin?
You know, to be honest, although my mom had this lifelong fascination, I was kind of late to the game. So I was well into my to my adult years. I was touring with my rap crew, Doomtree. And I left the tour van for a moment, which is really hard to do. You're kind of like working as a seven-legged sack race around the country. But yeah. I ran away from the van, and I found a garage sale. And on offer was Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma. And I'd meant to read that for like 10 years. So I picked it up, started reading it in the van, and it had a really big impact on me. Yeah.
What happened?
So I think I saw my mom get excited about ag and the way that we produce our food through her concern in environmentalism. And that wasn't the driver for me. For me, it was in paging through this initial text and learning about how the food system routes like money and power in our country. And particularly as a rapper, I'm aware and maybe hyper aware of privilege and class politics, because I realized that, yeah, for obvious reasons. For those of you on the radio, I am like a middle class, 5'10", white looking girl.
But still,
I, you know, I'm very aware of that. My mom's Puerto Rican, but I'm fair enough to be mistaken for Caucasian through and through. So I'm aware of the different way that I maneuver through the world than the rest of the dudes in my crew might, or the rest of the rappers with whom
I
work.
And you see food as the mover and the shaker.
I do.
This is the
at
place
least
where
a part.
Things separate.
How do broke people get to eat here? How do rich people get to eat here? Uh-huh. Who can afford food that has been produced by people who are paid well? When I go to the grocery store, like, where does that dollar that I spend on food go? And a lot of it goes to, like, big pharma. Is there producing the kind of prophylactic antibiotics that you're going to use, like, in a feedlot to keep animals healthy, mm-hmm. even as they're eating corn, which they're not particularly well adapted to do? And I was supporting a lot of systems that didn't really align with my values very well, if at all.
But, okay, practical question. You're on tour constantly.
Right.
When you're doing a show and you end up at, what, 10:30 at night, mm-hmm. It's not a matter that you can go out to a great place and pick up from a deli that has, you know, organic,
right.
It was raised right next door, that kind of thing. You're living with food that you can just grab. So
totally. This
has got to really be tough.
It is. And so I'm always like careful not to be too like didactic about it, because I'm not like this perfect model, right? We don't like travel with a chicken coop, you know, trailer or anything. And I love, and also just my palate is lousy. Like I love like Snickers and whiskey, you know, that was what I would live on.
May I ask you, what is wrong with Snickers and whiskey? I'm a bourbon girl. What about you?
Yes, I love bourbon.
You love bourbon. Okay,
makers.
Good.
But yeah, so even, you're right. Therein is like, if you have this like burgeoning sense of conscientious consumerism in the food system, the least likely place to be able to execute on those ideals
is as a
indie rapper.
But didn't you guys take on, you and the Doomtree Collective, take on a challenge that you were trying to eat organic and local when you were on tour?
We did. So when I was traveling with my solo band, of which Abby's a member, we were lucky enough to get a grant to be able to try to not only eat locally for one meal a day and see where that was possible and where it wasn't.
Right.
Mobile, no. Seattle, yes. But also to be able to visit growers and natural markets. And we set up free concerts along the way to be able to talk to small organic producers who... One of them was so cool. She was all tatted up, and she was like 5 foot nothing. And she just had like a machete on her hip and would just like harvest greens for you and then like put them in your mouth while she talked to you. So cool. It was awesome. But it made it even harder, to be honest. Like I thought I'd kind of done my due diligence eating organic and eating very little meat. And this made me reconsider a lot of that. What is food miles? Gosh, how would I even know how the people who harvested my food were treated? Yeah. It's tough.
There's something, quote, and you said this at one point, my takeaway is not to let the size and the scope of the debate be so intimidating that I'm afraid to engage, which I think is true of a lot of us. We see the scope and we realize there's a lot we don't know. So there's this huge hesitation to say, well, I'm going to kind of go out there and talk about what I think. And also, not to let the perfect stand as the enemy of good. What do you mean by that?
So sometimes I think when you talk about food, you end up in this really unfortunate water slide that goes something like this. Well, I'm going to go to the co-op because they have a local sale today. And then he goes, oh, well, I know a more local grower at the farmer's market that supports orphans. And then the next person goes, are those real leather shoes? I hope not. And all of a sudden, you're having this kind of one-upsmanship of, like, moral sensitivity, which is so stupid and does nothing but, I don't know. Instead of trying to make sure that you are absolutely addressing every moral issue and are irreproachable in any way, to say, you know what, I can make four big changes. And then if those stick, I'll try five. You know? And to be sensitive and empathetic with the people who are working on different changes. And yeah.
So where is this? So where do you think this is all going to take you?
I'm going to say, for one moment, forget me. But I know that a lot of the conversation here is about how privileged the conversation is to have. Like, yeah, that we're so lucky that we can spend the extra $2 at the co-op. I know it's not the solve, but I was excited when Walmart went all organic. Is that going to fix everything? No. But I think learning how to do things on scale or in lots of little tiny scalable ways is going to be, I hope, the future. As for me, I'm hoping for a Pulitzer in the next 20. That's my goal.
I'd vote for that. I would vote for that. Absolutely.
Thank you. Thanks for all your work, Lynn.
Thank you, Dessa. Thank you.
Dessa's latest CD is Parts of Speech. We have a bunch of videos for you to check out. You can take a look at the rest of Lynn and Dessa's conversation on the stage at the Fitzgerald Theater, as well as Dessa's killer performance from that night. And you will also find a video Dessa shot on the road called Dessa's Farm Tour. Find it all, splendidtable.org. One more thing. All this month, we're heading up a campaign to get more people to listen to podcasts. It's a pretty simple concept. You tell a friend about a podcast you are sure that they will love. It could be The Splendid Table, of course. And if they don't know how to listen to a podcast, show them how to do it. Tell us what you recommend with the hashtag tripod. That's TRYPOD. Thanks for spreading the word. I'm Sally Swift. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Sally Swift. Jackson Pollock was the action painter of the 1950s. His big canvases, spattered and blobbed with paint, defied all conventions. He was an equal opportunity iconoclast whose work ended up in major museums. So we know about Pollock the artist, but what about Pollock the gardener, the forager, the baker, and the party thrower? Living out on rural Long Island, he and his wife, the artist Lee Krasner, cooked what they grew, foraged and fished, and they entertained like crazy. When their house became a museum, the food side of their lives was totally ignored. That is until Australian photographer Robin Lee visited the museum. She was intrigued by their pantry. All the equipment said serious cooks. Then, flipping through their cookbooks, she found a stash of handwritten recipes by Lee and Jackson. And now we have Robin's book, Dinner with Jackson Pollock, Recipes, Art, and Nature. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for calling.
So tell me why you are so interested in Jackson Pollock.
Listen, Jackson Pollock, I think for a lot of people internationally, including us in Australia, is a sort of an iconic figure of 20th century art. And as I was growing up, I was very aware of the power of the symbol of this person who changed the course of art. And part of that was because in Australia in 1973, the National Gallery purchased a major work of his, Blue Poles, for $1.3 million, which was a huge scandal at the time. And that just became solidified in all of our young minds as this sort of extraordinary turning point for Australia, that we had acquired this major work of this iconic man.
And scandalous because of the cost?
It was because of the cost. At that stage, there were very few works being sold at that sort of level.
Now, you went to the Pollock House on an assignment that wasn't about food. What was it like for you when you found those recipes?
Well, it was kind of overwhelming in the sense that it was very unexpected. I went originally taking some photographs and writing a story for a magazine, and then kept going back in different seasons, and of course ended up in the pantry because, being a foodie myself, that's sort of the spot of the house that I'm drawn to. And basically, after speaking to the director of the museum, she said that they did have some handwritten recipes of Lee Krasner and Jackson Pollock. And then with further investigation, diving into their recipe books, we found dozens of others inside the backs and front covers of these recipe books. And it felt astonishing. I was surprised that not every inch of that house had been sort of devoured and dissected by researchers over many decades, but I suppose their focus was the art and the studio. So, it was one of those moments that I thought, here I am from Australia, discovering this very domestic day-to-day side of a man who's become an icon.
Yeah, you do not think domesticity when you think about Jackson Pollock, I have to say.
You don't, and yet he was a man who loved, pottering in his garden, gifting his vegetables to his friends, baking loaves of bread and apple pie. And yes, it's a different side to this man. And I think it's a story that warrants being told because of the fact that someone like him becomes a caricature, the more famous they become. And, I feel like that these are lovely, simple, everyday stories that match with beautiful, heartwarming recipes.
So, Robin, I was kind of struck that he was the baker of the two, which you would not associate with him and his wild ways.
Exactly. And I think coming into the project, I felt the same way. I thought he was like this, genius, paint-splattering icon. And I didn't think that he would be precise enough to approach baking a loaf of bread. He won a prize for the apple pie at the local fair. He would often bake bread. But interestingly, in recent scientific studies of his work, including one that's currently at the Guggenheim in Venice, titled Alchemy from 1947, there's a grid and there's a layout, a sort of an underlying sort of textured layout that shows that there was an incredible precision to the way that he approached his work. And interestingly, in that same work, not only is there this sort of structure that shows the precision of the approach, but funnily enough, that painting was painted on a tablecloth, which to me is like the ultimate combination of, food and art.
Huh, that is interesting. And Lee was...
So Lee was more of a, scribble down a recipe at a dinner party, who cares if the spelling's not right, throw things into the pot. But she was also, that shows the intuitive side of her as a cook, but she was also a very strategic hostess. She would gather collectors, gallerists, people around Jackson at the table and make sure they were there, they were loving their meals, they were having these interesting conversations, and she would talk to these people about his work. And that dinner party marketing was fundamental to his success. So it says a lot about her, I think, in terms of being very strategic. She was also sometimes quite dictatorial in the way she wanted food presented. She would often ask friends like Francile Downs to prepare dessert and bring it over, but it had to be prepared in exactly this way with this particular type of, pear, and it had to be laid on the platter around like this, and the sauce would be drizzled just so. So, a very particular aesthetic that she wanted to bring to the table, and I think that's very reflective of her creative outlook.
Yeah, and her relationship, right?
Exactly, exactly.
She was an artist as well.
She was an artist as well, and interestingly, when he died, if you look at the works after he died, you can see this sort of explosion of colour and like food-like forms, actually. In fact, some of the titles, there was one titled The Seasons and another titled Cornucopia. And they're very visual, vivid, rich colours and, I think, food themes. So I don't know if I'm just searching for those things. I'm seeing that right now in her work. And it was interesting that sort of explosive color came out after he had died in 1956.
I wondered as I was working my way through your book how Jackson Pollock would look at some of the plates that chefs send out these days with those batters of sauces and drips and drabs, and it's, of course, very similar to his artwork.
Yes, it is indeed. In fact, a foodie friend in New York, Harris Damachek, pointed out to me that most of the chefs that he works with often say they're inspired by Jackson Pollock. And I obviously there's a sort of, there's a freedom, the concept that there's a freedom there, you know, composition, color, form. You can see why that's the case.
That's great. It's very interesting. Thank you for joining us, Robin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Robin Lee is author of Dinner with Jackson Pollock. You can find Jackson Pollock's recipe for upside-down cherry cake on our website, splendidtable.org. Are elite chefs craftsmen or artists? It is apparently a debate we are still rabidly interested in because Netflix is releasing their third season of the documentary series Chef's Table. Filmmaker David Gelb follows chefs from all over the world, probing into not just what they cook, but who they are. Our new host, Frances Lam, talked to David about the very first season of Chef's Table when it launched in 2015.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's awesome to be here. Thank you.
So, Chef's Table, this is a beautiful show, and the food looks gorgeous, of course, but really the stories are so rich. But as I was watching, I kept thinking, okay, is this a show about chefs? Or really, is it a show about drive? Or is it a show about creativity? Or is it a show about sacrifice? So what to you is this show about?
I think it's about all of those things. And it's very much a character-driven series where each episode is about a character who is obsessed. They're all completely obsessed with what they do. And so, you know, there are artists in all different types of fields that do this, so it certainly isn't exclusive to being a chef. But to be a chef and to be a great chef, you must be obsessed. It's one of the hardest professions. I mean, to own a restaurant and to be a chef, which is, you know, each of our chefs, well, most of them are owners of the restaurant as well. And, you know, you're running a business that has to perform on point every single evening. And, you know, as a filmmaker, I get to make something once and then you can just play it and it's the same every time you play it. But for a chef, it's a lot more like performing on a stage in a way, because every single night you have to be at that level of excellence because you never know when the food critic is going to come or when the journalists are going to be there. And one off night can be a catastrophe. And so I'm just so kind of impressed by the drive of these chefs, people who have been telling them, no, it's impossible, their entire lives, and they all have kind of fought through that. And I just think it's incredibly inspiring.
Hmm. And how did you select the chefs that you wanted to profile?
Well, we're looking for people who have kind of forged their own pathway and kind of created their own version of their cuisine. So, for example, Massimo Bottura, who is now on the San Pellegrino 50 best list, the number 3 restaurant in the world is Restaurant Osteria Francescana, and he has 3 Michelin stars and is world renowned. But when he started, he was considered to be a bit of a food heretic in Italy, especially in Modena, where he's from. There's a very strong gastronomic tradition there, and you know, you're really not supposed to mess with grandma's recipes. That's what they all say. And he was determined to kind of reinvent that cuisine. And that's very similar to what Nikki Nakayama does in Los Angeles with her version of kaiseki. And it's very similar to what Francis Mallmann does. You know, he works always with fire and outdoor environments and making that his own. And so we're really looking for chefs who are defying the conventions and being really brave. And, you know, that's not dissimilar from Jiro Dreams of Sushi, because even though now, you know, his style of sushi is really kind of the standard of what people call traditional sushi, at the time when he was starting out, he was a bit of a radical. And that kind of courage is something that we're really looking for in our characters. Courage, relentlessness, and kind of a purity of vision that they refuse to compromise.
Hmm. You absolutely, that comes through so much when you watch these films. But when you bring up Massimo, I also think of Lara. Mm-hmm. Lara is his wife and in many ways has been sort of his creative collaborator. But she has this really striking moment where she says, I forget the quote exactly, but she says, you know, when I married Massimo, I married his restaurant. And when you bring up Jiro, it also makes me think, you know, everyone walks away from that movie, A, totally in love with the sushi, and everyone also walks away from that movie so struck by the chef's integrity and the chef's vision and the amount of personal sacrifice that chef will make for his craft. But I think the other thing that comes out is how much that personal vision makes everyone else around the chef have to make personal sacrifices of their own, right? Mm. Lara feels like she's married a restaurant, and Jiro's sons have worked in his shadow for decades upon decades because he won't let up and he won't basically retire. So that's a really interesting tension. As a filmmaker, are you drawn to that tension as part of the character? Like, does that undermine the story you're trying to tell?
Oh, not at all. And, you know, I think that one of the themes that we consistently explore is the cost of greatness or the cost of, you know, wanting to be great. And there's always a cost. And it's something that's very interesting to me as a filmmaker because I think it's interesting to anyone that, you know, has a creative job because, you know, there is an urge to just stay in the office and not come home at night because you have this kind of relentless desire to be the best and you just have this drive. You just don't want to leave it. Like I have trouble leaving the editing room just as many of these chefs have trouble leaving the kitchen. And we love to explore that because at its heart, this show isn't so much about what they're cooking or what their technique is, but it's really about the why. And we're trying to figure out, you know, where does the drive come from and why do they do it? And in many cases, they're doing it for their family. This is the great kind of contradiction. You know, they're doing it for their family, but at the same time, it removes them from their family in certain ways.
Yeah. And what draws you, I mean, obviously the stories are really intense, but what draws you to making movies about food as well as the chefs? Is there something about capturing the food scenes that is really interesting or inspiring to you?
Well, I love to eat. And, you know, that comes from my parents. My mom, Donna Gelb, is a recipe chef, and she's worked on two of the books of Frances Mallman, who is featured in our series. And, you know, she was very much an inspiration for me. She always, you know, we would always eat well. And when my parents used to be together, we would travel, and my mom would always take me to the, you know, the best restaurants, even though I was a little kid. And, she's always been kind of testing recipes at home for various magazines or cookbooks. And so I think that this kind of love for food comes from, you know, just from my childhood. And shooting the food scenes is always a lot of fun, you know, because the plate itself is already a work of art. And then we're trying to find the best way to capture the essence of that. And then the crew gets to kind of dig in because we wouldn't want to let the plate go to waste. So that's one of the most fun parts of the shoot. And the crew loves that part.
Yeah. And these food scenes are so like melodic and so beautiful, and they're set to the music as well. But when you shoot them, are they choreographed or are they just documented? How do you actually capture them?
Well, you know, in Jiro Dreams of Sushi, there's a scene that we refer to as the Sushi Concerto. And that's the scene where Yamamoto-san, who serves as a narrator of sorts for the film, walks you through what Jiro-san's omakase course is like. And he, you know, he kind of describes it as a symphony, you know, with three acts to it, which I thought was kind of a beautiful description. And we kind of have carried that over where, you know, in each of our shoots, we would have what we called a food symphony, where we would the kitchen would essentially work for us for a little bit before service would start. And yeah, we would set up, you know, our lighting to make sure the food would look beautiful. And we have kind of a robotic camera that can do very specific choreographed camera moves. And it's a lot of fun to shoot them because it's really, it's like, you know, how do I draw the audience's eye into what I'm seeing when I'm sitting here and eating this? You know, before we do a shoot, we always have a meal at the restaurant so we can kind of experience the food. And then we think about ways that we can kind of transport the audience's perspective into what we have just experienced. So we're always kind of just trying to share what we're discovering while we're shooting.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, well, thank you so much for talking with us today, David.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
David Gelb is the creator of the Netflix series Chef's Table. The third season is out now. Frances Lamb, by the way, is now our new host and will be here with his inaugural show next week, so don't miss it. Well, that's the show for this week. Remember, you can get to us anytime. We love to talk to you. 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. I'm Sally Swift. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, let me leave you with this thought from the undeniably wise and quick Oscar Wilde. He said, "I am not young enough to know everything." If you heard something today that you just have to know more about, head to splendidtable.org. You will find recipes, an extended version of Russ Parsons' conversation with Yotamoto Lengi. You can sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And don't miss a week. Subscribe to our podcast. Get on it. Jen Russell is our senior producer. Courtney McEwen is our production assistant. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Frances Lamb will be here next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Sally Swift, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.